Alive, the boy shouted. She's being brought on the Carpathia. All of New York stayed on the subject for the whole month of April. Mila said she couldn't sleep for thinking of it, all those drowned people in the icy waters, so far from home. When the Carpathia arrived, it was swarmed with those who wanted to get a look at the survivors, most of all Mrs. Astor, who stopped to let a holy man bless her pregnant belly. And when the McKay-Bennett got to Halifax with 300 of the bodies, Mary wondered why the survivors came to New York, but the dead did not. And what a gruesome job for the men at the docks that day. In May 1912, one whole year after Mary started at the bakery, Jacob pushed open the swinging door that led to the kitchen and told her to come up front. There was a man there who wanted to see her. "A man?" she asked. "For me?" Mary's hands shook as she returned the sifter to its spot. Evelyn halted her beating of half a dozen eggs to glance at her. "Did he ask for the baker, or did he ask for me by name?" "Just come up front," Jacob said. And Mary noticed that it was unusually quiet up front for that hour of the morning. Normally, Mary could hear the chatter of customers at the counter, making their selections, some standing there eating what they purchased straight from the paper bags. But that morning, she heard nothing except the sound of waiting, and Jacob holding open the door as she went to the sink, washed her hands, dried them, unpinned her hair, and then pinned it again. If Alfred went to the building first, they would have told him where to find her. The Borriello boys met her sometimes, walked home with her, and even Jacob had gotten used to seeing them there. Sometimes she sent day-olds with them at midday, so they could eat them before she got home. When there were lots of day-olds, she sent enough for Fran and Joan as well, and she knew that sometimes those stale pastries and cookies and slices of pie never made it to 33rd Street. Sometimes those two rascals found a patch of sidewalk, set themselves up on the ground, and ate every last crumb. She touched her fingertips to the counter and thought of him standing out there. She would know in an instant if he was off the wagon or on. She pictured him married to Liza Meany and decided it was best to believe that he was when she pushed out the door to face him. That way she wouldn't be disappointed. But she didn't see anyone until Jacob stepped aside, and she saw a man who was not Alfred standing before the window, his hands clasped behind his back. "Mary Mallon," Dr. Soper said. He didn't step forward. He didn't extend his hand. "I'm just after telling your boss about your history, and he's agreed that you are to be let go." Mary felt all her blood rush to her throat and a reverberation begin in her ears. She staggered and placed one hand on the counter. His hair shone. His eyes shone. His cheeks were as smooth and bare as a baby's bottom, and his mustache was trimmed to perfection. Every single little hair. He was, as she remembered him, a wax figure, a nose that could stick a pig, a pale, ineffectual weakling of a man who preyed on healthy, strong women. "He's told you lies," Mary said to Jacob, her voice a choked whisper, and then noticed the counter, where the newspaper articles about her case were lined up and labeled. "I can't risk it, Mary," Jacob said. "Have you had any complaints?" she demanded. "Has anyone come back to say they were made sick from what they ate here?" "I've already told him that they haven't, but he said that doesn't matter. If they got the fever, they might not realize where they got it. We wouldn't know." Mary picked up a plate of lemon squares and flung them across the room at Soper. Soper stepped neatly to the side, then reached over and locked the entrance door. "What did I tell you?" he said to Jacob. "Please, Mary," Jacob said. "He says we can't sell anything until you're gone and the kitchen scrubbed. I'm losing money every minute. If the DOH puts a notice in my window, I'm done for. Do you understand?"
"Miss Mallon, please gather your things and come with me," Soper said. "I'm bringing you directly to Commissioner Liddell's office."
Evelyn slipped through the swinging door and put her hand on Mary's shoulder. "You're making a mistake," Evelyn said to the men. Mary felt herself sway, and Evelyn braced her harder. She let Evelyn guide her to the back room. "It'll be fine. You'll get something else," Evelyn assured her as she stuffed the largest box with pastries.
"You don't understand,"
Mary said as Evelyn dropped loaves of fresh bread into the canvas satchel Mary took back and forth every day. He'd come with news clippings, and yet no police. He'd found her by chance. He'd carried the clippings around in his pocket. Maybe he'd followed her. Maybe the DOH had let him see her file, and he'd gone looking for that address. One digit off, a building that didn't exist. He'd suspected but wasn't sure, so he sussed out the situation himself. If he'd been sure, he would have brought police.
Right now, she figured, he was strongly regretting not thinking out a better plan.
Go now, this way, so you won't have to face him, Evelyn counseled. I'll stall him.
Mary had taken one step out the door to the alley when she thought to explain to Evelyn what had happened. How would she put it? With only a few seconds. How to make her understand?
I used to cook for a family uptown, and they said...
Oh, I followed your case, Evelyn said, pushing her out with more force. I recognized you on the first day. Mary gaped at the woman, and Evelyn shrugged.
You didn't lie. You told your name.
Go on now, Mary. Good luck. Clutching the box of pastries and with her bag of bread pinned under her arm, Mary ran down the alley and out onto the avenue.
21.
Mila watched in silence as Mary swept her powders and creams from the sill. In the 20 months that she'd lived there, Mary was careful to keep her things within the space she'd been allotted. Under her cot, the windowsill, a shelf in the pantry, one drawer in Mila's dresser.
Where will you go? Mila asked as Mary shoved her belongings in her old velvet satchel.
I don't know, Mary said as she looked around for the boys' scratch pads. But when she found them and touched the tip of the pencil to the paper, she realized she didn't know what to say. She drew a picture of a bird, and below it, two stick-figure boys holding hands.
What will you do?
Mary asked as she picked up her satchel and placed it at the door.
What will you do?
You write to tell me where you land, she said, and Mary swore that she would.
And you'll come back, won't you, after everything has settled down?
Yes, yes, of course.
Why don't you go down and stay with Fran for a while? If they knock, I'll tell them I haven't seen you.
Mary imagined Soper showing up with an army of policemen behind him. She imagined them staking out the entrance of the building, kicking down doors, throwing back bedclothes, and peering into closets.
I'm sorry, I just have to go.
She had been rushing since she left the bakery and felt breathless, faster than everything moving around her. She passed Fran's floor without slowing, passed Joan's door, glanced down the hall toward Driscoll's old rooms, where a young man had been living for a year. And when she burst out onto the sidewalk, she bent her head and walked north, for no reason except that there were fewer people in that direction, and she'd be able to walk faster. She hopped onto the trolley on 36th Street, and held on as it turned, then came to an abrupt stop to let a dog cross the track, and again a half block later to let people on. She exited at the rear and hoisted her bag over her shoulder. There had been no trace of Alfred since she left him behind in the vestibule that early winter morning, almost a year and a half earlier, and she considered going to Nations to find out if they'd seen him. But when she got her chance, she kept going, past the bright blue door, past his other favorite spots. She arrived at Grand Central Terminal, where she dodged the trolleys approaching from every direction and entered the building. Once inside, she followed the ramps up and around until she came to the main waiting area, the ceiling so distant it might as well have been the sky, and found an empty space on one of the long benches lined up before the timetable. Every person who passed her was on his or her way someplace. The seated looked up at the board once in a while, then at the clock, then back down at their hands to wait a few minutes longer. The announcer made a boarding call for Scarsdale, for Poughkeepsie. From behind her, they called for Philadelphia. The best dressed waited in a separate area for the 20th Century Limited to Chicago. She scanned the boards for a train to Dobbs Ferry, and then watched closely as the people who wanted that train stood up, checked behind them for forgotten items, hurried off. The announcer made another boarding call. Another. Mary moved her bag from her lap to the floor by her feet and felt her back bend to the curve in the wood. She touched her fingertips to her closed eyelids and felt a tingle in her nose. The sob that had been brewing there all day rise up like a wave lifts itself from the rest of the ocean, rushes forth, spreads itself on shore.
"Madam?"
A man tapped her on the shoulder. He wore a uniform, a jacket, and matching cap.
"Would you like to wait in the women's parlor? Do you know where it is?"
Mary thought he meant the lav, so when he led her to a large oak door and knocked twice, and then told the woman who answered that Mary just needed to rest and should not be charged the 25-cent fee, she felt afraid that he'd misunderstood something about her, and when they found her out, there would be trouble. But he encouraged her forward, and the woman who opened the door led her first through a small room, where women's light spring coats were hung, and then into a larger room, finished in a quartered oak, a Persian-style rug covering the floor. She pointed out one of the several rocking chairs. "Thank you," she said to the woman, and the woman gave Mary a small curtsy as she backed away. Mary registered the small, round vanity mirrors placed here and there, the full-length mirrors by the changing rooms. Though it was set up like a lounge in a private home, every step of a woman's toilet was available for sale, and adjoining the oak-paneled room was a fingernail manicuring room, a shoe polisher, a hairstylist, a seamstress. There was an area where a woman could change from traveling clothes to evening clothes, and women in blue uniforms bustled about to help. One approached Mary, reached for her bag, but Mary clutched it closer and the woman went away. She could have stayed in that warm and gleaming room for a month, but they wouldn't have let her, and so what was the point of staying for even an hour if she knew she'd have to leave again, eventually, and had nowhere to go? She studied a painting on the wall, a river, a field of flowers, and remembered her promise to John Kane that she'd look him up, go walking with him one day. She could go to him, she knew. She could meet the ferry, and when he got off, she could approach him, tell him what had happened, ask if she could stay with him for a while, and he would let her. She'd have to listen to him, and he might pretend at first that he wouldn't let her, but he would, in the end. She knew he would. Or he might know of someone who needed a boarder. There was a brother, too, she remembered. Something wrong with him. But nothing she couldn't handle, she was sure, just until she got on her feet. She would be kind to him. But when she left the ladies' parlor and made for the uptown IRT, she paused only for a second at the top of the steps before she walked on, walked east, back to the boarding house where she'd stayed before finding her cot at Mrs. Post's. If the woman remembered her, she made no sign, and as she was led up the back stair, she knew, before they stopped at a door, that it would be the same room she'd slept in back in 1910. "Breakfast at 7, the woman said, and when Mary shut the door and dropped the latch, she collapsed onto the narrow bed and slept. Breakfast was two rows of glum faces spooning porridge into their mouths, chewing, swallowing. Mary pushed away her plate. When she stepped out into the sun, a dozen pigeons clucked and flew off as one. Along with the loose gray-black spots they left on the sidewalk were feathers, old milk cartons, a box of cracker meal broken open and left now to be blown around in the breeze. With her bag slung over her shoulder, she walked for an hour, west mostly, but also south. She stopped to stuff paper into the heel of her shoe. Her shoulder ached. At 10, she stopped at a park, took off her shoes, and walked on the grass behind the benches while she ate a pear. When there was not a single bit of flesh left on the fruit, she picked up her bag and continued south, until she came to City Hall, and across from City Hall, the almost complete skyscraper where Jimmy Tiernan spent his days hanging dozens of stories above the sidewalk, guiding terracotta panels into place. The pyramid at the top made the whole thing feel like a cathedral, Mary thought, as she tipped her head back and gazed up. "Jimmy!" she called out when she saw him coming almost 2 hours later, one set of hunched shoulders among so many. There was a ring of yellow sweat at his throat. "Mary!" he said, and stepped away from the pack. His lunch pail was small in his large hand. "Can I talk to you a second?" "What's happened?" he said, crossing his arms over his chest. "Did Patricia send you?" "No," Mary said, and hesitated. The other men were watching them. They were lined up now against a wall, some squatting, some standing, some sitting, spread-legged. They pulled sandwiches and thermoses from the depths of their pockets and ate. She turned her back to them so she could see only Jimmy.
"I wondered, if you ever found out where Alfred went?"
"What do you mean?"
"Don't you remember looking for him last year, when there was a job here for him?"
"Sure, but did he disappear again?"
Mary blinked up at him.
"What do you mean? Did you find him after that?"
"You mean you didn't know?"
"Know what? I haven't seen him."
Jimmy took her by the elbow and led her over to the steps of City Hall.
"There was an accident, Mary. A fire. A lamp exploded in his hands and he got badly burned. He was in Willard Parker for months, and then at a hospital for burn people up in Harlem."
Mary shook her head.
"What are you talking about?"
"I found out only because I got so curious. I went over to the stable one afternoon to see if they'd seen him. They said it happened right there, at the stable, just before Christmas in 1910.
"Jesus Christ!"
"Then, when he got out of the burn place, he came down here looking for me, looking for work, I guess. but there wasn't nothing to give him. So I says to him, "Brayhoff, what you should do is head west to one of them middle states. Good work there. Make yourself a little house." And I swear to God, Mary, I think he did it. I think he just went and did it, just like that. Crazy as a loon, that guy. You didn't seem to want to talk about him, so I told Patricia to tell you. I know you two don't get on so well, but I figured she'd told you or told Fran to tell you, and you ladies have talked about it and decide what to think about it. And then I figured he'd write to you. He'd asked about you, you know.
No. No, Patricia didn't tell me.
Jimmy picked up his sandwich and offered half to Mary. She took it, gratefully.
Where's the hospital?
Oh, West 127th, I think. Maybe 128th.
Between Broadway and Amsterdam.
Maybe they know where he went? Maybe they have an address?
I doubt it, Mary. When he came to see me, it was November, 6 months ago. And then if he headed west...
How could he have traveled so far away without telling her? How could he have been so badly hurt without her knowing? They sat in silence, looking up at the top of the skyscraper.
55 stories, Jimmy said. You believe that?
Mary could just make out the shape of a man on one of the beams near the top.
But he was all right? Recovered? How bad was he burned?
Pretty bad, but he was better when I saw him.
Why didn't Patricia tell me? You should have double-checked, Jimmy. You should have known Patricia wouldn't tell me. I have a good mind to go up there and tell her what I think of her.
Jimmy sighed.
Don't take it up the wrong way, Mary, please. We have enough trouble.
The burn hospital was newer than the buildings surrounding it, the stonework not yet blackened. She expected something like Willard Parker or like Riverside, but it was a modest building, 4 stories. No sign of its purpose except for a small placard over the door with simple letters, St. John the Apostle Burn Recovery Hospital of Morningside Heights. There were trees lining the street, and a group of young girls clustered around a toy pram. Mary rang the bell, and the door was answered by a nun dressed entirely in white. The nun ushered her into the small, marble-floored reception area. The halls were silent, and Mary glanced quickly up the stairs at a large, stained-glass window on the landing between the first and second floors. Aside from Central Park, where it was possible to hear birds and crickets in summer, and aside from North Brother, it was the quietest place Mary had ever visited in Manhattan.
"I'm looking for a patient named Alfred Brayhoff," Mary said to the man in a whisper.
The sound of a bed being rolled on casters echoed from an upper floor.
"I know he's been released, but I wondered if you had an address for him."
"Brayhoff," the nun said. "Excuse me." Bending her head so that Mary could not see the expression below her habit, the nun turned to a desk and pulled open a lower drawer. She ran her fingers across the names at the top of the files. Forward and back her fingers crawled. She closed the drawer and opened another, ran her fingers again. "Brayhoff," she announced, pulling a file out of the drawer.
"Released," she'd said once she looked it over. "Let's see here. Yes, back in November."
"Pardon me, what is your relationship?"
She glanced at Mary's bag, which she'd placed on a bench in the waiting area.
Mary cleared her throat.
"I'm his sister. Just found out about the accident. I'm visiting New York, and this is the last place I have for him."
"I see." The nun turned back to the file, and Mary prayed that it didn't note anywhere that he was German. She considered what she'd say if the nun asked Mary to explain how brother and sister could have different accents.
"He signed himself out."
"Is there a new address?"
"No, I'm sorry."
Mary sighed.
"Was he very bad?"
The nun tipped the file so that it would flap open again.
"Hard to say," she said after a moment of reading. "He was here for several months. That's a long time. On the other hand, he's alive. He left."
"Yes," Mary whispered. It was true.
"Does it say anything about him going out west to find work?"
The nurse shook her head.
"No, but if he left the area, that would explain why he missed his follow-up appointments. Patients with his injuries usually come in to get new prescriptions once a month."
Mary thought of all the states he'd ever mentioned wanting to see. How would she find him now? A piece of paper slid out of the file and onto the floor.
"Wait," the nun said.
She read the sheet that had fallen.
"I see. He stopped in just a few weeks ago with a few complaints. You were right. He'd been in Minnesota for a few months, but he returned just a few weeks ago, and the doctor gave him new prescriptions. It references that he lives on 125th Street, but it doesn't say east or west or any building number."
The nun turned the paper over to check the back. I suppose you could try the doctor's office. Explain that you're his sister. The nun took a pencil from her pocket and scribbled the doctor's address on a corner of the paper and then tore the corner off.
Thank you.
I assume you already tried his next of kin.
Who?
His wife. I imagine she knows where he is. Though, seeing her address now, I wonder why he isn't living with her. Perhaps their situation changed due to his injury.
His wife?
Mary tried to control her expression.
It's been several years since I've seen my brother.
Well, he listed a wife when he was admitted, the nun glanced down. Mary Mallon of East 33rd Street.
22.
When Alfred woke, he was on his back, a pillow tucked under his head, another under his arm, a small, square window, a distant ceiling, a closed door. He shifted his leg and gasped at the pain it brought. Part of his body was covered with gauze. There was a lamp on the table beside his bed, and he tried to turn toward it. He lifted his right arm and felt a brilliant heat light up inside his body and blossom forward, pushing out from his muscle and bone. When he opened his eyes again, there was a nurse looking at him from behind a clipboard. He opened and closed his eyes several times. Sometimes it was light in the room, sometimes dark. Sometimes a man was watching him, sometimes a woman. Usually no one at all. In the background there were sounds. Shoes scuffing a linoleum floor. People talking in low voices. The squeaking wheels of a rolling cart. But instead of interrupting the silence, the atmosphere of total stillness, of nothingness, that sensation of floating through an in-between place, the noises only emphasized the void, drew attention to it, and after every small bump or rattle, the world seemed even quieter than before. Several times a day, from somewhere so near his body he knew he could reach out and touch it if he could make his body work, was the delicate tink of glass and the unmistakable flick of a finger, once, twice, and then a pinprick, usually in the crook of his elbow, sometimes in his forearm, occasionally the back of his hand. After a moment, one, two, three, he felt a small quiver at his center, pressure on his chest and head that lasted just long enough for him to begin feeling panic, and then peace, as if someone had warmed a blanket by the stove and pulled it up over him, tucked it in at his shoulders and turned out the light. It was a feeling like being born, a baby tucking chin to chest and pushing into that dark tunnel, or the lead weight used to plumb a depth, and the prize was reaching that destination, finding the depth, and sometimes he felt the sea rocking under his bed. He heard the sound of the ocean. He heard his mother's voice, took in the smell of the Alps, German grass under his feet, German air. Then, as if he'd taken one giant leap across the continent and ocean, he was in New York, a mountain of coal behind him. Mary on the other side of a gate. Mary stirring a pot with her back to the room. Mary unpinning her hair and shaking it loose. He spoke to his father. He spoke to his brother. He laughed with Mary as they danced in Coney Island, in Hoboken, in Manhattan. He whisked her across the gleaming black and white floor of his hospital room. He was 7 years old, and there were thin slices of pine strapped to his feet. He was 15 and strong, dodging a policeman on Mercer. He was 40 and tired, but summoning the strength to get up and start again. Eventually there were things he knew, and so somebody must have told him, though he couldn't think of who or when. Time stretched and stretched until it snapped. An hour felt like a week, and then a week felt like a day. He knew it was the new year, but then the nurse put a hand on Alfred's cheek and told him it was the Ides of March. March already. Almost spring. He was in a hospital. He'd been badly burned. There was some question about whether he'd use his right arm again. Everything below the elbow had been destroyed almost to the muscle. His upper chest on that side was in better shape, but there was still a risk of infection. Had he spoken to them? They asked him questions sometimes and waited for answers. How do you feel? What exactly happened? Don't you know how lucky you are? They fed him. They washed his body. Catholic? He nodded. Yes. He guessed he probably was, but had he ever been baptized? He'd been to Mass a few times with Mary and her Aunt Kate. A priest came to offer the Eucharist one Sunday, and he opened his mouth to accept it. After, he had bad dreams about them finding out and putting him on the street, but he continued to accept it, Sunday after Sunday, and eventually he looked forward to the priest's visit, the knobby hand he always placed on Alfred's head before leaving. On Easter Sunday, they brought him lamb with mint jelly and fed him in forkfuls small enough for a child. On the 4th of July, they told him to look toward his window, where he could see flashes of blue, pink, bright white sparklers rising up and landing somewhere nearby. He could hear birds, and then, after a few weeks, the birds disappeared. Spring and summer had come and left again. They told him he was getting better. He had no infection. He'd be able to use his arm one day, though it would not be pleasant to look at. His nerves had been badly burned, and yes, that was bad news. But on the other hand, it meant he wouldn't feel pain there anymore. He was being moved. It would be uncomfortable, but they'd give him something for it. The burn hospital was uptown, they'd told him. It was a charity hospital, run by nuns, all of whom had vowed to live in service to St. John the Apostle. They didn't expect anything in return. A donation, perhaps, whatever he could spare. It was in a quiet neighborhood. "Quieter than this?" he asked, and they laughed. "Something for the journey," the nurse had said, and he closed his eyes to listen for the tink-tink of the little glass vial. There were trees outside his window at St. John's. Their shadows swayed on his wall when the wind blew. The nuns wanted him to walk more, to do laps around the hallway. They wanted him to practice lifting a teacup, gripping a fork, washing himself. He complained of itching all over his body. He vomited. He didn't like it there. He wanted to go back to Willard Parker. They gave him his medicine by tablet, 2 round white pills 3 times a day that he placed on his tongue and tipped back into his throat before the nun could pass him a cup of water. The pills helped, eventually, but not like the needle. The needle sent him floating from the very instant it punctured his skin. Syringes were expensive, a nurse explained, and they were a charity hospital. They had to use what they were given. Morphine, opium, codeine, cocaine, heroin. Tablets, tinctures, salts for sniffing. It was all the same, all for managing pain. They wanted to be a bit careful about the morphine, they told him. In the past, they'd noticed several patients had difficulty weaning after they were healed. Several doctors suggested cocaine or heroin instead. They usually brought him a tincture of opium after supper, and he swallowed every bitter drop, but he couldn't sleep in so much silence. The groaning of the trees kept him up all night. It was too cold at St. John's, and when it wasn't too cold, it was too warm. He was getting worse.
"You are not getting worse," a nun informed him in a subdued voice. "You have healed wonderfully. It's been more than 10 months since the accident."
He wanted to take her by the shoulders and shake her. Didn't they realize the extent of his injuries? Even when he finally slept, it was not restful, and only when he began howling through the night, waking the other patients, did a harried doctor appear with a needle and syringe. After he was serene, he slept. They added the nightly injection to his bedtime routine. He spent afternoons trying to make his way around the corridors, and he wondered at his old self, how he always seemed to be on his way somewhere, itching to get free of whatever room he was in. Now, even with so little to do, the days passed quickly and sweetly. He walked. He rested. He considered the shadows on the wall. He closed his eyes and listened. He returned to his room for his medicine and noted that he never had to even look at a clock. His body told him when it was time, and sure enough, usually within a minute of returning to his room, resting at the edge of his bed, someone would appear with a white cup, and he took anything they gave him as he anticipated the after-supper hour when the doctor would appear with the syringe. In November, they told him he was ready, that he should start planning. Was there a job to get back to? Someone to contact? Crystal Springs had given him a settlement of $100, which by some miracle the hospital hadn't taken from him. He left $25 to the nuns. On the morning of his discharge, they shaved him, cut his hair, gave him a suit of clothes, a hat, shoes, a small container of tablets for the pain. A doctor named Tropp, who kept hours at the hospital and had his own office nearby, would prescribe something else if the tablets didn't do the job. If he ran out of medicine and Dr. Tropp was unavailable, he should go to a pharmacy and ask for something. Any druggist would give him a tincture of opium or a small dose of heroin until the doctor could see him.
When he got outside to the street for the first time in 11 months, he walked immediately to Dr. Tropp's office. He told the doctor that the nuns had given him pills, but that at night he needed something stronger. Just as he'd hoped, Dr. Tropp asked if he was familiar with administering medicine by needle. "Of course," Alfred said. Once Alfred had paid, the doctor handed over a small bag containing a single glass syringe, 2 needles, several vials of liquid morphine, a prescription for more. Back on the sidewalk, Alfred placed the bag carefully in his jacket pocket. He climbed the long staircase to the L platform and protected his pocket as the train pulled in and the other riders pushed against him. His arm was ugly, but worked just fine. He could grasp a fork, turn a knob. Sometimes it ached and felt tired. They had shown him exercises to make the muscles stronger, but he found the medicine was the best to help that feeling of lopsidedness, of tightness on one side and looseness on the other. The medicine was an equalizer and made his whole body the same, his thoughts peaceful and quiet, and the days kind. His chest was taut, like the skin there had shrunk, but the medicine helped that, too. With the medicine, he felt at ease, and he moved along the paper-strewn streets in an even rhythm, throwing one foot loosely in front of the other, feeling the momentum of his arms swinging by his side. Even his head felt perched perfectly at the top of his neck. At 34th Street, he climbed the stairs to the street, walked south 1 block and then across, all the way east, until he spotted the old building. He halted, brushed his pocket to make sure nothing had been damaged. He moved a little closer and then sat down on a stoop. Was she still at the same laundry? Still staying with Mila? It wasn't long before he saw her, walking up 3rd Avenue from the opposite direction, a young boy on either side of her. They were talking, competing for her attention, and she was serious with them, though Alfred could see that whatever they were saying, she was happy. She was holding a box. She placed her hand on the head of the shorter boy, and he took the box from her. The 2 boys ran ahead, and she shouted something after them. She touched her collar, the back of her hair. She looked young. Nowhere was that put-upon expression she used to wear, that hard look she got when she moved around him in their rooms, running a rag across the counter, closing her mind to the fact that he was there. If he washed a pan, he should have scoured it. If he put away the sugar, she found some he'd spilled on the floor. He was useless. He was lazy. He was a drunk. He didn't love her. He didn't know the half of what she did for him. "Alfred," she used to say, more softly than she ever spoke when he was sober, "you have to stop this." She quickened her step, and Alfred walked out to the middle of the sidewalk. She was directly across the street now. If she turned her head, she'd see him there. "Do it now," he told himself. "Now." But he just watched her, and then she was gone. Disappeared into the building and up the stairs. Driscoll was dead. The Lower East Side was off limits in case he would run into Liza, so Alfred paid the bartender to sleep on a cot in the back room of Nations for a night. He had no desire to have a drink, and again wondered at his old self. The next morning he went downtown to talk to Jimmy Tiernan. Jimmy knew someone who knew someone who'd gotten work in Minnesota, clearing land, and who said it was the best work he'd ever had in his life. Hard work, but good work. Clean air. No punch card. No boss breaking balls every minute. Jimmy wanted to go there himself, but Patricia would never agree to it. They could build a log house. 3, 4, 5 rooms, however many they wanted. They could clear land and sell the timber. They could keep livestock, plant crops. But the farthest Patricia would go was Queens. He laughed. "But you," he said to Alfred, "what's stopping you? Go in the spring when the weather isn't so bad." It had been raining in New York for 2 weeks. Steady, gray, wet rain that made the city wilt. In Minnesota, in the winter, Jimmy said it gets too cold to rain. The air would freeze the damp hairs inside a man's nose, but at least the sky was blue and big. A train left Grand Central Terminal for Chicago 2 times a week. From Chicago, Alfred could switch to a train headed for Minneapolis. From Minneapolis, he'd just have to find his way as the days took him. It was difficult imagining there were cities so far away, cities with their own riverfronts and barges and garbage and odors. It was sobering to think of traveling so far at such speed and still covering only half of America. New York was not like the rest of America, not even close. Anyone who read a paper knew that. In Minnesota, every farm had good water, a creek slicing through, rich earth, plentiful grazing. The people ate only white bread and meat every day. The trees grew up straight and grazed the sky. There were people who set up their homes and didn't see other families for all of winter, which in Minnesota lasted a full 6 months. In New York, there was no way to escape other people, acquaintances and strangers. They brushed by him every minute of every day, begging for coins, asking that balances be paid. They bumped him in the street without apologizing. They smelled at their kitchens, their cabbage and beets and smoked meats and spices brought all the way from the old country, sewn into the linings of cuffs and pockets. They grabbed the best of the fruit at the market and grazed his toes with their automobiles or their wagon wheels as he crossed the street. Minnesota wasn't the only option. There were other places. Wisconsin, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Arizona were said to be hot year-round, and if a man went walking in the desert, he'd be tanned like leather inside an hour. There were Indians in the Middle Country. New York had places with Indian names, but no Indians anymore. They'd all gone west. He told Jimmy it was a good idea. He didn't need to think about it. He'd go. He'd build a house there, way out in the country, and send for Mary. One way or another, he'd convince her to give him another chance, to join him out west where they could truly start over again. He hated thinking about the last time they'd spoken, that morning in the vestibule of the old building, the sight he must have been after so many days drinking, sleeping here and there, and the look on her face that told him how serious she was, how desperate she was to make him go away. When he spoke to her next, he'd have something to show for himself, a plan. She'd see how sorry he was. "Now?" Jimmy had asked. "Wait until Christmas. Wait until the New Year." "Now," Alfred said. He bought an honest ticket to Chicago and an honest meal aboard the train, but for the switch between Chicago and Minneapolis, he slipped onto the train and into the tiny lav until the train started moving. When he finally opened the door, an attendant saw him and was about to shout when Alfred held up his hand and then, with the other hand, reached deep into his pocket. A dollar would shut him up, and was still less than the price of a ticket. Feeling tired and beginning to worry that it was a terrible idea to venture so far from New York, Alfred stepped back into the lav, and with one foot bracing the door and the other on the ledge of the commode, he removed a needle from his jacket pocket, wiped it on his shirt, attached it to the delicate syringe, and pushed it into one of the small vials of morphine. He drew the plunger back as the train leaned into a turn. For the rest of the journey, the young man ignored him as Alfred slept across two seats at the rear of the car, and when he wasn't sleeping, he stared out the window at the trees, which grew taller and stronger the closer he got to Minnesota. He pictured the trees in New York, imagined them gasping for air, fighting for space. Once in Minneapolis, he found the riverfront and got a job loading sacks of flour as big as a man for the gold metal factory. The boarding house he found was cleaner than any he'd seen in New York, the people less threatening. They all looked at Alfred with some curiosity, and after a few days he realized he was the one they thought of when they locked their doors. The worst of his arm was visible only during the inside hours, when the men worked so hard they started steaming, and Alfred rolled up the cuffs of his shirt. The nuns had given him a bad haircut, and he hadn't shaved since Harlem. He needed to clean his clothes. He needed to find a doctor and a druggist. Seeing the bruises on his arm and on the other arm, the deformed skin, a man on his shift suggested a place on Hennepin Avenue that would help him. A smoking lounge, the man called it, and Alfred went there expecting it to be run by a Chinese. But, like everything else in Minneapolis, it was run by a white, a lean man, once blonde, with a beard and a caftan tied around the middle with a rope. The man had come to Minneapolis from San Francisco and greeted Alfred as though he might be a long-lost brother from the opposite coast. "They're different here," the man informed Alfred. He instructed him on how to hold the pipe and waved a hand toward the chairs scattered around the eerie silence of the room. Alfred didn't respond, so the man returned to the front room, and no one spoke to Alfred. He chose a rocking chair by the window, which faced the Mississippi and a little island in the middle of the river. He thought of Mary and her hut. When he closed his eyes, he saw her pacing, looking out across the water toward him. He wondered if she'd gone looking for him since the accident. He assumed Jimmy Tiernan had told her what happened, and he knew he should send her a letter. He hadn't had a drink since Christmas 1910. He would tell her that. Or maybe it would be better to wait until he'd been north, seen what it had to offer, seen what kind of life they could make there. After 2 weeks, he began asking for work up north, clearing land. The men he spoke with told tales of snow that reached the tops of trees, air so cold it would freeze a man's pecker in under 3 seconds if he went out to take a leak. The fish froze in the rivers. Birds that didn't go south dropped from the trees like stones and woke up again in the spring melt to fly away. He'd have to drag his food out there and back. He'd have to pack enough for 4 months at least, maybe 5. He'd have to be strict about what he ate so he wouldn't run out. "Cover up that arm when you go looking for work," a man advised him. "No one will want to see that coming." "It's ugly, but it's fine," Alfred said, looking at the skin of his right arm. It reminded him of candle wax, melted, lopsided, dips and ridges where the wax ran free. He couldn't feel anything on the surface of that arm, and so sometimes he had to look down at it to see if his shirt sleeve was rolled up or down. Sometimes he dug his fingernails in, hard, but all he felt was pressure on the bone. "No, I mean that," the man said, taking hold of Alfred's good arm and holding it to the light. "What are you going to do about that?" Alfred pulled his arm away and, quick as a gasp, had the other man's arm twisted behind his back. "Don't touch me," he growled. The man didn't speak to him again. Hauling flour was exhausting work, and at night he slept from the moment his head touched the pillow to the moment the sun reached his face. He heard of a clinic alongside Lake Harriet where the doctors understood about pain management and gave out prescriptions for those who could pay for it. Alfred showed his injuries to a Dr. Carlson and explained his plan to go to the North Country after Christmas and work up there until spring. Dr. Carlson wrote a prescription for a winter's worth of tablets and 4 large bottles of tincture, plus additional morphine, 2 more needles, another syringe. Alfred paid for all of it and noted that he was going north just in time. The drugs were cheap. A vial of morphine was cheaper than a bottle of whiskey, but still, his stack of money was growing lighter every day. The doctor told Alfred to try to limit his intake or he might have stomach trouble, difficulty getting going in the morning, problems sustaining energy throughout the day. "Stay out of the dens," he warned Alfred. The smoking opium was mostly smuggled, and who knew what went into it. "Stick to the prescription stuff, the stuff that had been checked out by the Board of Health." He took the tincture in the mornings and felt it travel his body as he ate his breakfast. The pills he kept in his pocket, the needles he saved for night. The itch that always began a few minutes after waking subsided by the time he began his walk to the riverfront, and everything seemed at arm's length, as if he were looking at someone else's life. Before, in New York, he was so much a part of his own life that it nearly drowned him. But now, it was as if he floated alongside himself, and when something wasn't quite right, he could simply lean over and make an adjustment. At the boarding house, Christmas was acknowledged with bread pudding, a round of carols, and mulled wine. A French-Canadian named Luc, part Indian, sold him an overcoat from the Hudson Bay Company. From a consignment store, he bought heavy blanket trousers and a shoe pack, and the patient clerk showed him how to ease them on over 2 pairs of socks. If he did it right, the man swore, his feet would stay warm and dry. He bought 2 pairs of thick wool socks, 2 shirts, 2 vests, a fur cap. In mid-January, Luc told him about a pair of brothers who'd purchased several acres on the cheap and needed a pair of good axemen. "Are you handy with an axe?"
"Sure," Alfred said.
"I'll bet you are," Luc said, but told him to meet him in a few days. When the day came, Alfred showed up wearing all the clothes he owned to find Luc had organized everything they would need onto 2 toboggans. When Alfred tugged his, he guessed it weighed 300 pounds. They had cornmeal, flour, lard, butter, a variety of smoked fish, ham, rice, molasses, axes, matches, picks, spades, hoes, sugar, guns, powder, and shot. Alfred had a season's worth of medicine buttoned into his interior pockets and could hear the faint rattle of the tablets as he moved. Luc had arranged for a wagon to carry them to the crossroads nearest to the brothers' camp, and then they went the last 12 miles on foot, their toboggans sliding so easily along the crust of ice on the top layer of snow that they left no tracks. They came upon the brothers after 4 hours of walking. Gustav and Eric had made their camp on the edge of a pine grove, against a fallen tree trunk almost 6 feet thick. When they saw Luc and Alfred, they stopped their work and walked over to pull the toboggans the rest of the way. The camp was as clever as Luc had described. Poles cut neatly and laid sloping from the snow to the top of the tree trunk, topped with layers of spruce boughs and covered over by a rubber blanket. The brothers had banked the snow on the back and sides of this little structure and built a fire in front. Each man had 2 blankets, and there was a pot slung over the fire. It was a clean place, as sterile as white cotton, and Alfred felt his lungs growing stronger, his body becoming cleaner. Luke showed him how to wield the axe, how to bend the saw, and he got faster at it every day. Gustav and Eric saw his burns and didn't question him when he administered his medicine at night, nor in the morning when he washed the pills down with black coffee. His body worked like a machine, and there was peace in the sweating, the breathing, the aching at night that was so completely different from the ache of his hips after lying in a hospital bed for almost a year. He ate more in one sitting than he used to eat in New York over an entire day. The older of the brothers commented that Alfred was getting stronger, and Alfred knew it was true. He held one side of the saw, and Luke, or one of the Swedes, held the other, and where it used to take 50 passes to cut through a trunk, now it took a dozen, sometimes less. Back and forth, back and forth, the teeth of the saw bit deeper into the pale interior of the trunk, and he'd feel his heart throbbing when the Swede pulled for the last time, held up his hand to watch the tree fall. They dragged the timber to the river where, in the spring, they'd trade it for meat and fresh fruit. The sun went down early, before 4 o'clock, but the moon was so big and the stars so bright that Alfred realized nighttime meant something else that far north. There was no wind, nothing to stir the trees, and everything was so still and silent inside the warm cocoon of his woolen mitts and oilcloth that he forgot the temperature. Minnesota was something to experience, and Alfred thought of Mary, how she'd have liked to see the sky so clear. The tent was as warm as any house, and Alfred wondered at his old self, always searching the corners of his pockets for a coin to put in the gas meter, how every person in New York was a slave to what he earned. Out in the cold wilderness, he'd have no need of money until the spring. He wanted to tell Mary about it. He wanted her to see. Then, one morning after Luke headed off to the crossroads on an errand to trade timber for a stump extractor, and as the brothers were halfway through a trunk as thick as a man laid on his side, they could see that the tree was leaning in the wrong direction and beginning to tip. They shouted to each other in their own language, and quickly, foolishly, Gustav, the older brother, threw his hands up and put his shoulder to the bark as it began to fall. From across the cleared space, a distance of 75 yards or so, Alfred watched in dumb silence. He saw Gustav make a sudden move, and then the tree was down, and Eric was shouting. Alfred stared for a second longer, and then realized Eric was shouting at him. Gustav was unconscious when they carried him into their shelter, and when they opened his shirt, they could see right away that his shoulder was dislocated. "He's alive, thank God," Eric said, and Alfred nodded. It was true, but what did that matter now, when they were in the middle of nowhere with an injured man? Luke was not due back for several days, and neither Alfred nor Eric had any idea what to do. "Should we try to get it back into place?" Eric asked. "I don't know," Alfred said. Eric took hold of his older brother's arm, and, after dipping his head for a moment and drawing his breath, he placed a knee on his older brother's chest to keep him still and tried to shove the arm back into the socket. He tried again, roaring as he did so. Now Gustav was awake and also roaring. Eric tried again. Again. He tore off his brother's shirt to get a better grip. He gave his brother a spoon to clamp between his teeth. As Alfred held Gustav's legs, it occurred to him that they'd want his medicine. He told them it was for pain, and Gustav's pain was clearly worse than his own. He'd have to give it. If he didn't give it, they'd take it from him. They were peaceful men, but they were brothers, and they'd sooner kill him than have one of themselves harmed. He calculated how much was left from the clinic that overlooked Lake Harriet. He'd been disciplined about his dosage, treating himself to extra only a handful of times, and then only when the air was so cold and the skin over his wounds grow so tight that he was afraid it would crack open again. He offered before they could ask, and they took it, gratefully. Days went by, a week. Luke had not yet returned, and Eric wondered out loud if he should go to the crossroads himself or send Alfred. Alfred understood the dilemma. With just 3 of them at camp, and Gustav too injured to move, the one left behind would have to put caring for Gustav above all things, and only Eric would do that. On the other hand, electing Alfred to go to the crossroads meant trusting a virtual stranger to do what he'd been asked to do, to find help, send it back to the woods to the brothers. The brothers didn't trust him, Alfred saw now. Eric took and took Alfred's medicine for his brother, and when Alfred suggested that he'd given enough, that he had to save some for himself, Eric looked at him so coldly that Alfred knew his first instinct had been correct. Better to keep giving than be killed. His dreams grew terrifying, and he found he couldn't sleep at all. His body hurt. He became nauseated. There were no odors in the North Country except pine and cold. The inside of his nose felt raw, and he imagined a frozen path from his nostrils to his lungs. He woke up one night to Eric, shaking him awake. "What's wrong with you?" he asked, and Alfred realized he'd been shouting, thrashing. There was no sympathy in the question, only accusation. It wasn't Alfred's fault that Gustav had miscalculated the tree. The Swedes talked all day long and sang songs, and where before their red faces had seemed so merry, now they seemed to Alfred to be part of their selfishness. They were monsters, the two of them. Who but a monster would choose to live so far from civilization, would dig a hole in the snow and call it a place to live? There were strange animals in the North Country, tracks he didn't recognize, and he knew they were all gathered somewhere deep in the shadows of the pines, waiting to see what he would do. He would always be the odd man out, even if he handed over every single drop, every pill. Gustav didn't seem to be getting worse, but he wasn't getting better, either. And now, when Eric gave him more of Alfred's medicine, Alfred felt his blood rise. "He doesn't need it," he said. And Eric looked at Alfred like he'd stepped out naked from behind a curtain. Alfred took bigger and bigger doses at night, and again in the morning, so that he could get his share before the Swedes took everything. No more trees were cut. Where before, the days had been full of the sounds of work, cutting, cracking, splintering, chopping. Now the days were as still and silent as night, except for the occasional sound of the skillet on the fire, the pop and crackle of bacon meeting the hot pan, Eric's boots crunching the top layer of snow outside their tent flap, and finally, 10 days after the accident, the sound of cracking on the river, like a volley of gunshots every few minutes, a racket unlike any Alfred had heard in his life. "You have to go to the crossroads," Eric told him one morning, 2 weeks after the accident. "Luke should have been back days ago. Send him back and bring help as well." He put his hand on his brother's head. "I think there's something broken inside, not just the shoulder. A few bones, maybe? I don't know." "I'm not sure I remember the way. Did we pass one other clearing or two? Can I take the compass?" Eric looked at him with disgust. "You are not an axe man," he said, bitterly, as he shoved the compass to Alfred's chest. "Leave that medicine for my brother's pain." He put his hand on the barrel of one of the shotguns that was lying on its side by Gustav's head. They kept it loaded in case of passing deer. Alfred fished out one bottle of pills and gave it over easily, knowing he'd be back in the city soon. "And the rest," Eric said, using the shotgun to tap Alfred's other pocket. Alfred closed his fingers around his last vial of morphine and the second bottle of pills. "I need it to get back. I can't walk all that way and pull my things without it. I need it for rest. I don't..." Before Alfred could catch his breath, he was on his back and the Swede's knee on his neck. He reached down with his good arm, found the bottle and vial, and pushed both into Eric's face. When he got to the crossroads, he found Luke sitting between two men in the only public house for 15 miles. All three glanced at Alfred as if they'd been expecting him. Alfred told Luke about the accident, told him about Gustav's injuries, but Luke nodded off while he was speaking. So Alfred returned to the crossroads to look for something to carry him back to the city. It was April, and spring had already arrived in Minneapolis. The stink of his body was strong now that he was back where women wore tailored spring coats and the men were neatly shaved. The smoking lounge was shut down. At the boarding house, he asked about work so he could pay his way back to Chicago and then to New York, but no one knew of anything. He went to the clinic on Lake Harriet and bought more medicine with the last of his money. It was a mistake, this place. All its foreign cleanliness. The shops closed early. The food was bland. All anyone talked about was his next meal, the weather, going hunting on the weekend. He had to get home as soon as possible. Thank God he hadn't talked Mary into coming to this place. He walked down to the stockyards and then over to the train station where several cargo cars were being coupled on the main track. When the railway man went inside the station house, Alfred walked along the track, peering into the dark cars. In one, he sniffed corn. In another, buckwheat. In a third car, he looked left and right and then noticed from within the darkness a pair of eyes. He felt a chill and stepped back. "Get away," a disembodied voice growled. "Or get out of sight." Alfred climbed up and quickly moved to a shadowed corner. Where's it going? He whispered. East? As his eyes adjusted, he saw that the man was really a boy, 15 or 16 at most. Another voice said, Boston.
Hold on, buddy, the second voice said. Are you sick?
No.
If you're sick, we're not getting help, you understand? We'll bury you in this shit and leave you here.
I'm not sick.
You look kinda sick.
If you get us caught, I'll kill you dead, the first voice assured him as Alfred leaned into his bed of yellow peas. After a while, he heard the lock thrown in place on the other side of the door, and the train began to rock toward the Atlantic.
His banner over me is love. 23. As she walked from St. John the Apostle to Dr. Tropp's office, Mary clutched the torn-off corner of paper the nun had given her and prayed that Alfred had given the doctor his current address. She hadn't seen him in 17 months. Who had visited him in all that time he spent in the hospital? Who had made sure the doctors were doing their best? Not Liza, she thought with relief, but not Mary, either. He'd been alone in this horror while she'd been oblivious, making pastry downtown. She had never before walked the neighborhood above Columbia University and noticed that all the hectic life and energy of Morningside Heights was muffled and then silenced in the space of half a dozen blocks. Around the university were brownstones as beautiful as those on Park Avenue and residential buildings with elevators inside. The sidewalks were neat, the lawns trim. Clusters of rose bushes punctuated the green spaces of campus like so many bright and shining jewels. But just above that, outside Dr. Tropp's office on 129th Street, the sidewalks were silent, the trash bins unattended for weeks. The few automobiles scattered about the neighborhood were parked in every direction, some facing west, some east, some with their wheels up on the curb. There was a pig pen by the river, and the odor hung over the surrounding blocks. No one answered her knock when she arrived at the doctor's office, so she let herself in and caught him dozing at his desk. "Excuse me, sir," she said, and when she was sure he was awake and paying attention, she told him that she was Alfred Breihoff's wife, just returned from abroad, and needed Alfred's address. She looked around. There was no secretary, no patients. After hearing her business, the doctor's expression became one of doubt, but he turned and searched his desk for a file. Breihoff, he muttered as he moved papers back and forth. I saw him only once since he came back from Minnesota. I can't remember if he gave me an address. Finally, he singled out a file from the mess and opened it. Ah, yes, he said, and Mary's heart beat faster. It's 545 West 125th Street. Mary tried to check her anticipation and reminded herself that she had not been kind to him the last time he tried to talk to her. Maybe he would turn her away now, just as she'd turned him away 17 months earlier. Maybe the months he'd spent out west, doing what, Mary wanted to know, had taught him that the empty spaces in his life could easily be filled, and maybe he had no interest in Mary anymore. The satchel she'd been lugging around the city since leaving the boarding house felt much heavier than it had that morning. She thought of Mila and the boys, and wondered if Soper had gone looking for her there. She hoped Mila could convince him that she'd really left, and then Soper would leave them alone. When she got to the building, it seemed a little like a hotel, but one where the bellhop and the doorman had abandoned their posts years ago and left the lobby to be pulled down by cobwebs on the rafters, buried by mud tracked in from the street. She scanned the list of names beside the buzzers, and there it was, halfway down. She pressed the button, and just as she began to worry that it didn't work, she heard the sound of a man's boots coming down the stairs. It didn't sound like the step of a sick man. An incapacitated man, a man hobbled with injury and pain. She knew he'd spotted her through the glass of the door when the boots stopped. He pushed open the door and stepped outside. Mary, he said, shoving his hands deep inside his pockets and leaning back on his heels. She noted the skin of his right hand, all the way up his arm to the place where his shirt was rolled to the elbow. His shirt tail was hanging out over his pants, and he wore no socks in his shoes. There were dark rings under his eyes, and his hair had more gray threaded through it than she remembered. But, otherwise, he was himself, and within 5 seconds of seeing him again, she knew that there was no Liza upstairs, no woman by any other name. She sniffed the air around him, out of habit, but smelled only aftershave, soap. His hair was damp, and he hadn't yet combed it. She tilted her head and looked closer.
He had none of that wolfish quality he had when he was drinking, always moving and itching to get out, always fiddling with something in his hands. Nor did he have that look he had back in 1909 when she'd seen him at the hearing. He was not full in the face, nor was he gaunt. He was not jumpy, and yet he gave off a gentle hint of impatience. She couldn't quite read him. "Can I come in?" she asked, and watched his face as he noted her bag, the weight of it. "Sure," he said, as if he'd seen her the week before. He walked ahead of her down the long hall, but waited by the bottom of the stairs for her to go up ahead of him. "Second floor," he said. He was quiet as he followed her up the stairs, his injured hand clutching the handrail. He moved slowly, carefully. When they got to the landing, he nodded toward a door to her left, and she pushed it open. "I heard about your accident," she said, once they were both inside. She held out her hand so that he would show his injured arm. The skin there was raw, melted, and cooled, and she wanted to run her palm over the surface, learned the new topography. There was no hair on that arm, and his hand appeared swollen, lumpy, as if it needed to be drained. She pressed the swollen part with her fingertip. "It's fine now," he said. "I was lucky." "I just found out," she said, as if this would explain why she hadn't sought him out earlier. "Then Jimmy said you might have gone out west." "Ah," he said, as if it didn't matter to him. "I was planning on sending you a letter, but then..." He trailed off, distracted by something she couldn't see or hear. He turned to the counter, began to open and close cabinet doors. His room was not neat, she noted, but it was not dirty. His bed was unmade, but the sheets appeared clean. The counter was cluttered with mugs and bowls and spoons, but all seemed washed, left there to dry. Dirty laundry was piled in a corner instead of scattered everywhere underfoot. Once she understood that he was well enough to live in the world outside the hospital, she expected a scene. She expected to have to make her case to him right away, to roll up her sleeves and peel the years back and back and back until they were exhausted, and there was nothing further to say except what was new and now and how they'd cope with tomorrow. She expected to have to draw a boundary and show it to him. She'd prepared herself for blame and had lined up a list of grievances she'd level at him if he implied for a second that their split was her fault. Instead, he seemed to barely register her presence. "Coffee?" he asked without looking at her. He turned over the mug on the counter and found another from within a cupboard that held only a few mismatched plates. "You all right, Alfred?" she asked. Maybe an accident like the one he'd had changes a person. Maybe she'd been too cruel, leaving him in that vestibule that time. Maybe he'd waited for her and waited for her, and when she didn't come back and didn't search for him, he'd had to shake himself loose of her for good. Maybe he'd made his own vows to himself, and her showing up now had knocked him off balance. She cast her eye quickly around the kitchen and noted a single bottle of Powers Gold on the top shelf of the cabinet, 2/3 full. She noted an empty bottle of Baby Powers next to the sink. Maybe this was a new kind of discipline. She smelled the air again, and again came up with nothing. Maybe, like a doctor, he'd learned his dosage, finally, and had become strict in measuring it out. He saw where she was looking and picked up the small bottle, dropped it in the trash can. "I didn't say anything," Mary said. He leaned against the counter, folded his arms. "What is it, Mary? Has something happened?" "I'm hungry, Alfred. Will we eat? Will I make you something?" "I'll make it." Slowly, and watching him carefully all the while, she explained everything to him over a supper of fried eggs and toast, cooked by him and served to her on a dish so clean she wondered if Jimmy had warned him, somehow, that she was headed uptown to find him. He smirked for the first time when she pointed out that baking and cooking were two entirely different occupations, and looked at her over his shoulder as if to ask if she believed that, or if she hoped he would believe it, before turning back to the stove to flip the eggs, first one, then the other. And she paused her story to lift her chin and peer into the pan to see if he'd broken the yolks. When she saw the eggs had remained intact, she continued, telling him about the bakery, about Evelyn and Jacob, about throwing the plate of lemon squares when she saw Soper's face. She lifted her chin again and told him the eggs were ready, so he slid them onto two plates, put the toast alongside, and when she pushed into the soft center with the hard corner of bread, it ran in a beautiful, pure, yellow river across her plate, exactly as it should. She told him about the Triangle Fire, about how strange it was that she could remember every single detail of that day, better than even the first day she left North Brother for the hearing, better than the day they set her free. She could remember what she was wearing, down to the undergarment, the man with the ink-stained shirt, the shirt itself, pale, pinstriped blue. She remembered the Lithuanians looking up at the rumbling ceiling with fear on their faces, and then the pandemonium outside, followed by the eerie calm of the days after.
"And you?" Mary asked. "The nun said you were released in November?"
"I was," he said, running the tip of his finger across the plate and bringing it to his mouth. "I went to Minnesota for a while, but..."
"But?"
Here it was. He appeared healthy, strong, sure-footed, and of steady hands, but here it was. Drinking on the job. Chronic lateness. What would it be? "It wasn't for me." He pushed back his plate. He got up to make more coffee. "What about you? Do you mean to stay here?" She felt him looking at her bag. She'd known him since she was 17. A lifetime ago, and still she was nervous.
"Yes,